Good afternoon. The Economic Subcommittee hearing on the performance of the Veterans Employment and Training Service will come to order. As I said in our first meeting, this subcommittee has a very simple mission to promote jobs for veterans. It's a simple concept, but one that takes a great deal of effort on the part of several governmental agencies. VA's Voc Rehab and Employment Program is designed to put veterans into jobs. The Veterans Employment and Training Service is about putting veterans into jobs. The President's National Hire Veterans Committee is about promoting the business advantages of veterans to corporate executive suites. The Uniform Services Employment and Reemployment Rights Act is about jobs for veterans. Veterans Preference is about federal jobs for veterans. Last week I said this subcommittee will focus primarily on two programs, VA's Voc Rehab and Employment and the Department of Labor Veterans Employment and Training Service. In our first hearing, we took testimony on VA's Voc Rehab and Employment Program. I think they are making progress on revamping what should be the VA's crown jewel of programs, but have significant work to do, especially in terms of measuring outcomes. Additionally, committee staff from both sides of the aisle have met offsite with senior management, VR&E and VETS to explore ways to increase integration of their operations. I believe the two agencies are preparing a joint master plan to further that goal and will provide it to the subcommittee early in June. Today we're here to conduct oversight of the Veterans Employment and Training Services, or VETS. With a budget of about $200 million, VETS administers the state grant program to support state employment service disabled veterans outreach program specialists and local veterans employment representatives, or the DVOPs and Leavers programs, and the homeless veterans reintegration program. Today we're here to learn about the overall performance of VETS. However, in the near future, I intend to hold separate hearings on the DVOP Leaver program and HVRP because of their importance. In addition, I anticipate further joint work with the Small Business Committee to further opportunities for veterans in the area of entrepreneurship. Additionally, I've scheduled a site to Norfolk, Virginia in mid-June to observe a transition assistance class. Before we hear from the first panel, I want to express my disappointment with the Department of Labor concerning one of its duties under Title 38, Chapter 41. Among other things, requires an annual report on VETS activities. This report is due to Congress each February. Unfortunately, we have yet to receive the report. As a matter of fact, the Department of Labor has not submitted the report since 2000. I sincerely hope the VETS failure to keep Congress informed is not indicative of its commitment to finding jobs for veterans. The President, with No Child Left Behind and many of his other initiatives, has truly stressed accountability. And again, you know, this is the way that I'm accountable every two years, as is the rest of the panel, and we're accountable to the voters, and then again, accountable in the sense of the oversight, and this is how we know what's going on if we don't get the reports. So we're going to get the reports. We're going to work it out. I want to emphasize that I'm open to new ideas and new ways to ensuring that veterans are properly prepared for and enter and remain in good jobs. I hope that today's panel will bring some new thinking with them. I know our ranking member, Ms. Stephanie Herseth from South Dakota, has a serious interest in this topic. I now recognize her for any remarks she may have.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much, and good afternoon. Good to see so many of you again. Mr. Chairman, thank you for holding this hearing to examine the efforts, accomplishments, and challenges of the Department of Labor Veterans Employment and Training Service. Indeed, the employment services and protections provided by VETS are critically important to service members, veterans, and military families as they seek success in the civilian workforce. Mr. Chairman, I'm confident that your steady bipartisan leadership of this subcommittee will provide a means for robust oversight over these important programs. The men and women who wear the uniform in defense of this country deserve nothing less than a top-quality employment service, as well as rigorous enforcement of reemployment laws. The state of South Dakota has a number of National Guard and Reserve units activated in support of operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. I'm afraid this situation may continue for some time. As you may suspect, I'm very concerned and interested in VET's efforts with respect to providing outreach and transition services to returning Guard and Reserve personnel, including any special efforts to assist rural service personnel. I'm also interested in examining whether VETS believes it has the necessary resources and staffing to provide sufficient and timely services under its broad mission. It appears to me that while the demand has grown for services, VETS budget request has remained relatively level. Finally, Mr. Chairman, VETS has responsibility for many important programs that can assist veterans in receiving training, gain skills, and obtain quality employment. I look forward to hearing more about these initiatives, such as licensing and certification, homeless veterans reintegration program, apprenticeship and on-the-job training, and the National Veterans Training Institute. I welcome all the witnesses today and thank you for your testimony. Your assistance and guidance provides important insight to an often complicated subject matter. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Let's go ahead and get started. The members of the first panel include Mr. Rick Weidman, Vietnam Veterans of America, Mr. Rick Jones, AMVETS, Mr. Jim McGill, VFW, Mr. Peter Gaitan from the American Legion, Carl Blake, Paralyzed Veterans of America, and Brian Lawrence, DAV. Mr. Jones.
Sir, Chairman Bozeman, Ranking Member Herseth, thank you for your invitation. AMVETS is very pleased to be here and want you to know that we share your concern about accountability. With thousands of veterans returning home from the global war on terrorism each and every day, addressing the employment situation of veterans in a positive way is a national priority. The Department of Labor Veterans Employment and Training Service administers two primary programs, the Disabled Veterans Outreach Program and the Local Veterans Employment Representatives Program. Each assists not only veterans, but also helps reservists and guardsmen who we recognize as playing an up-tempo role in the total force in today's national defense. For decades, these DVOPs and LVERs have been the cornerstone of employment services for veterans, and DVOPs and LVER staff are frontline providers for services to veterans. In our view, the folks who manage these jobs should be veterans. Let me give you an example found within our own organization of veterans advocating for veterans. The AMVETS Department of Ohio developed and fully operates a 501c3 career center designed to assist veterans in their career needs. The AMVETS Career Center now provides a range of services helping veterans learn more about computers, business math, business grammar, business management, and whatever is important to refresh or upgrade their skills for gainful employment. The AMVETS Career Center provides these services to veterans who are homeless, unemployed, or underemployed, those who want to prepare for a new career or better job, and to recently separated veterans who are making the transition to the civilian workforce. The center also provides non-veterans an opportunity to upgrade their skills for a modest fee, and the cost for veterans is zero. There is no cost for veterans. Mr. Chairman, this is just one example of the fine work veterans do for their fellow veterans. They have a natural attachment to the veteran and play a pivotal role in making sure veterans who come back to their hometowns have every advantage to excel and be part of the local workforce. On a related point, AMVETS is particularly disappointed that a proposal to transfer vets from the Department of Labor to VA is still being discussed. We have testified in opposition to such a shift, and we remain strongly opposed. Shifting vets to VA from DOL will not improve the employment situation. DOL knows the job markets. They know the skills that are required to fill jobs beyond any other executive department. And frankly, VA has its own challenges with resource needs to address veterans' health care and backlogs in the claims processing. Therefore, we do not believe that moving vets to VA is a proper or wise move, and we hope that you will continue to agree with us on this as you have in the past. A word about the budget. We're encouraged by the administration's recommended increase in vets programming, and we ask for your strong commitment in supporting adequate funding in the final appropriations for the new year. Mr. Chairman, this concludes my statement and look forward to any questions you might have.
Mr. McGill, you're recognized. Mike just mentioned that you're going to be retiring in June or moving on. Or?
Yes, sir. It's, I think my last day is going to be the end of July.
Good. Well, if we don't see you between now and then, it's really been a pleasure working with you. Hopefully we'll have you over here before then for
I'm sure you will,
for something. But like I say, we appreciate your service.
Thank you. Thank you. That came as quite a surprise. A pleasant surprise. Thank you. As our representatives of the VFW travel throughout our nation and visit military installations overseas, one of the most frequently expressed concerns is whether the military personnel will be able to transfer their skills to another job when they are released from active duty or when they retire. The VFW is also hearing from veterans who already have retired and realize now that they need additional retirement income. They too are concerned about the possibility of not being able to find employment. Veterans deserve and have earned an employment program dedicated specifically for them. They currently have such a program, and while the VFW does not believe that system is broken, we do believe it can and must be improved. The VFW supported the provisions of the Jobs for Veterans Act as it provided a crucial element for vets to be successful, and that being accountability. While progress is being made to implement PL 107-288, there are still no clear, well-defined performance standards that can be used to compare one state to another, or for that matter, one office to another office within that state. Even where such standards have been produced, vets and its regional administrators have almost no authority to reward a good job or impose penalties for poor performance. The only real authority, although seldom used, is the power to recapture funds when a state is in violation of law. The VFW believes this course of action could ultimately prove detrimental to the veteran and should only be used as a last resort. For several years, many have seen a need for standards to be put in place for disabled veteran outreach programs, or DVOPs, and the local Veterans Employment Representatives, or LVERs. Addressing this need, vets initiated performance measures in 2002 that applied to all veterans served by the Public Labor Exchange. These same performance measures were later applied to DVOPs and LVERs. These reforms are essential for a viable and accountable veteran placement program which meets congressional intent. The VFW believes vets must complete its development of meaningful and enforceable performance standards and reward states that exceed established standards by providing additional funding. PL 107-288 authorizes vets to provide cash and other incentives to individuals, but not entities. Congress should amend this law so such entities such as career one-stops may be recognized. Another area that I would like to address is the National Veterans Training Institute. NVTI is administered by staff from vets through a contract currently with the University of Colorado. NVTI trains federal, state, and employees and managers who provide direct employment and training to veterans and armed services personnel. NVTI curriculum offers courses for staff of the DVOTs and LVERs in core professional skills, marketing and accessing the media, case management, vocational rehabilitation, and employment program support. Congress must continue to fund the NVTI at a level to ensure training is continued as well as expanded to state and federal personnel. In closing, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to comment on the administration proposal known as WIA Plus. This proposal would fund the DVOP LVER program through a block grant to be used at the discretion of state governors. The grant would be administered by the Employment and Training Administration, thus resulting in vets having to relinquish all control and administration of the DVOP LVER programs. This proposal has the potential to ultimately lead to the dismantlement of both the DVOP and LVER program, as well as vets itself. The VFW believes vets is the proper office to continue to administer and provide oversight to this crucial veterans program, and therefore the VFW strongly opposes WIA Plus. This concludes my statement.
Mr. Blake.
Chairman Bozeman, Ranking Member Herseth, PVA would like to thank you for the opportunity to testify today on the Department of Labor's Veterans Employment Training Service. I will limit my remarks to just a couple of the key programs that VETS administers. The TAP and DTAP programs generally are the first service that a separating service member will receive related to employment. These programs offer job search assistance and related services. The TAP consists of a comprehensive three-day group of workshops at selected military installations both in the United States and in overseas installations. The DTAP was established for service members who are leaving the military with a service-connected disability. This program is meant to include not only the normal three-day TAP sessions, but also individual instruction to help determine job readiness for the candidate, as well as to address the special needs of disabled veterans. Although PVA believes that TAP has been a successful program, there remains more to be done. Continuing emphasis on conducting these programs at overseas installations is a must. PVA also believes that the DTAP program has not achieved the same level of success that the TAP program has. PVA members are more likely to get transition services from a DTAP program because they are exiting the military through the medical retirement process. However, many times severely disabled veterans needing DTAP services fall through the cracks, especially spinal cord injured veterans, who may already be getting health care and rehabilitation at a VA, a spinal cord injury center, or even a private rehab facility, although they may still be on active duty. Because these individuals are no longer located on or near a military installation, they are often forgotten in the transition assistance process. While the service member may be at a VA medical facility, they are still assigned to the nearest military installation as a medical holdover. And it is incumbent upon vets to ensure that the necessary staff go to the medical facility, whether it is a VA facility or a private facility, to ensure that these severely injured service members get the services that they deserve. The Homeless Veteran Reintegration Program, as I previously testified, is one of the most cost-effective and cost-efficient programs in the federal government. In spite of its success, it remains severely underfunded. PVA, as a member of the National Coalition for Homeless Veterans, supports the need to expand funding from the $22 million recommended level in the President's budget request for this year to the $50 million authorized level that was included in the bill that was considered by this committee last week. Perhaps the most important services provided by vets are done by DVOP coordinators and leavers. PVA and many of the other veteran service organizations worked for years to have clear performance standards put in place for both DVOP and leavers. In 2002, vets initiated limited performance measures based on the rates of employment and retention. Following the enactment of the Jobs for Veterans Act, vets began implementing more focused measures for vets and leaver, for DVOP and leaver staff, excuse me. These changes were meant to emphasize the placement of severely disabled veterans and other veterans facing barriers to employment to avoid some forms of cherry picking. Though it is unpleasant to accept, when someone's job is at risk, human nature may cause the employment specialist to select the easy placement over the ones that may require more effort. The revision of the duties of DVOP and leaver specialists in the Jobs for Veterans Act and the continuing efforts of vets to establish meaningful performance standards are essential to reinforcement of the services they provide. PVA welcomes these changes as they are essential to viable job placement service. PVA does have some concerns about the effect of proposed changes to the grant program that funds the DVOP and leaver staff. We are particularly concerned about the proposals that would provide a consolidated grant to the states for employment service programs, as Mr. McGill mentioned, the WIA Plus. Governors would then be given the authority to distribute grant money to any employment program they administer with no clear specification for priority of services. Although the Jobs for Veterans Act reaffirmed the priority of service to veterans and disabled veterans in employment service centers, PVA has seen no accountability measures proposed that would ensure that states adhere to this priority. PVA believes that DVOP and leaver staff positions will be at risk of being eliminated if funding for DVOP specialists and leavers is consolidated with other employment programs. It would be easy for these positions to be eliminated in favor of other employment services that the governor may deem to be similar to those being provided by DVOP and leavers. PVA looks forward to working with the subcommittee to ensure that veterans have access to the employment services that they have earned and deserve. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Gayton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chairman Bozeman, Ranking Member Herseth, on behalf of the disabled American veterans, thank you for the opportunity to testify on the needs and performance of the Department of Labor Veterans Employment and Training Service, VETS. VETS was established to help disabled veterans overcome challenges they face when seeking employment after completing service in the armed forces. As you know from my written statement, the DAV is pleased with the overall performance of VETS. But with the cooperation of the VETS staff, we have identified areas for improvement. We look forward to working with VETS throughout the upcoming months to ensure its programs are functioning at the highest possible level of efficiency and effectiveness. Reaching this goal will require adequate funding. At a time when budgetary issues weigh heavily on every government agency, the utmost scrutiny must be afforded to each request for greater resources. This is an instance, however, when expenditure should be considered an investment. Helping disabled veterans attain self-sufficiency is not only the right thing to do, it's a smart thing to do from an economic standpoint. Veterans who are employed contribute to the economy. Studies have shown that the GI Bill provided a tremendous and measurable boost to the gross domestic product. The DAV believes that investment in VETS programs now will produce similar results for decades to come. It is thusly important we ensure VETS remains in existence to fulfill its mission. The DAV believes an unintended consequence of the proposed WIA Plus legislation is the eventual abolishment of VETS. WIA Plus would provide via a consolidated grant, funding via a consolidated grant. Once the funding is established, VETS will lose oversight as to how the money is actually spent. VETS would have sign-off authority on state plans, but thereafter, the Employment and Training Administration, or ETA, would control the grant and the oversight that comes with it. The DAV has no confidence that ETA would ensure responsibilities assigned to DVOP and leaver personnel are exclusively dedicated to serving veterans. It was the lack of services dedicated to the unique needs of veterans that led to the creation of VETS in the first place. DAV is concerned that certain state employment centers have already assigned duties that are inconsistent with the VETS mission. The DAV wants VETS to have strong oversight authority to ensure that DVOP and leaver personnel remain focused on helping disabled veterans receive the maximum level of employment opportunities. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my statement, but I would like to add, before closing, that the DAV is encouraged by the bipartisan efforts of the subcommittee and the efforts that you've made to improve economic opportunities for veterans. Like the subcommittee, members of the DAV fall on both sides of the political spectrum. Yet we recognize that taking care of disabled veterans should be among the nation's highest priorities. Such a solemn responsibility has no room for political ambitions, and we are pleased that the subcommittee conducts business in such a manner. On behalf of our 1.2 million members, we thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lawrence. And I apologize. I was looking at my sheet and skipped you. But you all are on the ball and got things sorted out at the table. So.
We're sitting in order for that reason.
Yes. Mr. Gayton.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Chairman, I appreciate this opportunity to share the views of the American Legion on the performance of the Department of Labor's Veterans Employment and Training Services, its resource needs, and the state grant program, which funds disabled veterans outreach program specialists and local veterans employment representatives. Every year, 250,000 service members are discharged from the armed services. These former service personnel are actively seeking either employment or the continuation of former or vocational rehabilitation. The VETS program offers transitioning veterans the assistance they need to obtain employment. President Bush's FY 2006 budget request for VETS is $224 million. This marks a modest $3 million increase from the final funding allocated in the FY 2005 appropriations bill. The American Legion remains steadfastly supportive of vets within DOL, as administered by the Assistant Secretary of Labor for Veterans Employment and Training, and the critical role each program continues to have in the lives of America's veterans and their families. The American Legion recommends $339 million for the Veterans Employment and Training Service in fiscal year 2006. This would provide funding for the state grants for LVERs and DVOPs, the National Veterans Training Institute, the Homeless Veterans Reintegration Program, and the Veterans Workforce Investment Program. Additionally, the American Legion supports stronger oversight of funding for DVOPs and LVERs to ensure that the state grants are indeed earmarked for veteran-specific employment services. It is important that states be held accountable for the funds they receive under the DVOP and LVER grant program. The American Legion is concerned that the rate of job placement of veterans, training programs, and other vital services may have decreased. Under the previous performance data reporting system, veterans seeking employment and those entering employment could only be counted after a mediated service was provided. Under the current system, individuals only have to register and enter the employment system to be counted as an assisted veteran, thereby giving the false impression that the one-stop career centers are doing a better job of finding employment and training opportunities for veterans. The American Legion is concerned with not only how employment services are delivered by the one-stops, but also with veterans receiving priority of services as outlined by the 2002 Job for Veterans Act. The American Legion is pleased to hear from DOL officials that veterans are actually receiving priority of service. However, as you alluded earlier, sir, VETS has not published any data for determining how effective its priority veteran services are, nor have they reported to Congress on any progress made in regards to the implementation of key aspects of the 2002 Job for Veterans Act. The American Legion strongly recommends a revision of existing VETS reporting requirements for measuring performance standards and for determining compliance with requirements for providing employment services to veterans. The rolling quarter reporting system should be administered in a timely manner to better project the employment services being sought by veterans and to more accurately reflect the efforts of DVOPs and LVERs. The American Legion strongly believes funding levels for DVOP and LVERs should match federal staffing level requirements and that they be allowed to provide service to veterans only. Adequate funding would allow the programs to increase outreach efforts, as well as staffing to offer specialized comprehensive case management job assistance to disabled and other eligible veterans. With the dramatic increase in the number of veterans from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan being discharged, and the increasing importance of the one-stop centers in assisting all transitioning veterans, the American Legion strongly recommends that vets continue frequent monitoring visits to the centers and provide strict oversight of these programs. DOL must ensure that veterans receive priority in all programs and services created specifically for their unique needs. Mr. Chairman, this concludes my testimony. Again, I appreciate the opportunity to be here, and I am willing to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Mr. Weidman.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for the opportunity to appear here today, and because this is the first time I've actually had the chance to say so publicly to you and to the ranking member, as well as to Chairman Buyer and Mr. Evans, thank you so much for creating this subcommittee. The attention that needs to be focused on employment and on the means to earn gainful work, to have gainful work at a living wage, is, from VVA's viewpoint, for 25 years now, we've considered it to be the nexus of the readjustment process. Not everybody's going to need health care, not everybody's going to need a vet center, but everyone will need work. It could be the form of self-employment, small business, micro business, or a job, but everyone's going to need a job. And a symptomology of all of the other problems will ameliorate if you have work at a living wage. And so we thank you for focusing on this central issue, sir. Insofar as the history of the employment service, you will recall that in 1933, as part of the legislation that created Social Security and unemployment insurance, the job service was first created and was farmed out to the states along with administering of the unemployment insurance. Frankly, it was industry and business leaders wanted, if they were going to pay unemployment insurance tax and checks to workers who were unemployed, they wanted a way to try and get those people back to work as soon as possible. Thus was the creation of the Modern Job Service. From the very outset, veterans had priority within that system. It was in the original law. There were problems from the outset, and in part in 1944, as part of the set of laws that we commonly know as the GI Bill, there was creation of the local veterans employment representatives who were supposed to assist the office manager in ensuring that everybody in each job service office accorded the proper priority of service to veterans returning from World War II. Some cases it did, some cases it did not. Following Vietnam, the Workforce Investment Agencies, as we call them now, Employment Services, we call them then, testified on the other side of the Hill before Senator Cranston. They weren't placing any Vietnam or disabled veterans because they could not find them. I would mention to you, Mr. Chairman, that in the 1970s, when I returned from Vietnam, I was teaching at a four-year college in the Vermont State College System and an academic administrator, and because there were such significant problems with the job service not meeting the needs of Vietnam veterans, we formed a statewide Vietnam veteran community-based organization focused on employment and barriers to employment in order to meet the needs of our brothers and sisters, particularly disabled vets within the state of Vermont. And that happened all over this country because even then the employment service was letting us down. The DVARP program was created to say, okay, if you can't find the disabled vets and if you can't find the Vietnam vets, we will then create this program to go out and find those folks and bring them in. And that was created, and that was the genesis, first by executive order by President Carter, and then later on it was locked into statute, I believe, in 79, if I recall correctly. Throughout the 1980s and into the 1990s, Chapter 41 of Title 38, we added and added and added various and sundry prescriptive and proscriptive fixes to the problems of lack of will and lack of accountability out there in the states across this nation, with veterans still not getting the kinds of services which they, in fact, had earned by virtue of military service. Finally, in the late 1990s, this committee began to address this issue and led to a piece of legislation after an extraordinary year-and-a-half-long series of seminars, roundtables, etc., we thought was something that not anybody was totally happy with, but moving us toward a results-oriented system, something that is based on a GPRA, the Government Performance and Results Act, which Vietnam Veterans of America strongly subscribes to. And it was defeated at the last minute by some inappropriate action, and some suggest illegal on the part of one of the government executive branch officials at that time. Anyway, it threw us right back to where we are today. We have now a system that measures its success based on a fallacious system, in our view, where it's the post hoc ergo propter hoc fallacy, logical fallacy. Something happens, and therefore anything that comes after it is caused. Somebody registers with the job service and gets a job the next quarter or the quarter after that, and the presumption is, in the measurement system they use now, it's because they got something from the employment service or from the one stop that was available. In many cases, that is flat not true. Just look at the jump in 1 year when they finally implemented that system, I think 3 years ago, of almost 50% jump in their positive terminations in 1 year. What we need is good metrics that measure real performance, one, and two is a reward system, that means cash American, that is based on actual performance that is measurable. That is the heart and the essence of the Government Performance and Results Act. And so far as at this point, there are a number of specific things that we strongly urge the committee to take a hand in. One is pushing VETS to start to take steps to start to really measure the performance of the various state workforce development agencies. That can be started right there in their building by taking care of what used to be called the SPIR system, Statistical Participation Information Retrieval System, that tracks everyone in a WIA program, in a Workforce Investment Act program, in every state right down to the service delivery area, or the WIB level, as they call it today, in the nation. And yet that has not been done. There's not even been any nascent effort to do that. So that's number one. Use the system that you've got to start to track it. Secondly is implement regulations, publish through the public rulemaking process, regulations to fully implement the Jobs for Veterans Act. In the absence of regulations, there is no way in the world that the federal government is going to be able to hold either the states, much less the municipalities and the one-stop shops, accountable for whether they do or do not meet the requirements of the Jobs for Veterans Act. Number three is we would suggest that what we need is vet one-stops. I neglected and mentioned it in my executive summary, and I apologize, Mr. Chairman. There are two books that I meant to bring along today. One is called Veterans Come Back, and the other is The New Veteran. They are both written, one was written in 1944 and the other in 1946, and it details the kind of community centers that involve the private sector and representatives of all elements of the private sector in the majority of both small and large cities in the United States and all of the federal entities and state entities into veteran one-stops across this country. So it was a public-private solution to our, in a greater sense, the community welcoming back those who are fighting for us into the community. It wasn't something you let Gummit do. It was something that everyone did. And because it had private sector measurements involved, it worked, and we would suggest that we need that once again. And last but not least, I would close with what we, in our national president, in our legislative agenda testimony this year before Chairman Buyer and the full committee call for. And that is a national convocation. Now, we suggested that was to deal with all of the problems that returning veterans have and to look at, are we doing the right thing? Tap and DTAP, in many cases, don't work. The people who are really falling through the cracks, as was pointed out by one of my distinguished colleagues, is the Guard and Reservists who are demobbed, and they are not near anybody, and many of them are unemployed. I know somebody here in Washington who's told me about people in his unit where, because they were mobilized three times in the last 7 years, their spouse frankly said, I didn't sign up for this. They're no longer married. They come home, they're unemployed or way underemployed, and they're living in their car. And they're living in their car. And there's part of the total force. What does this do to our total force and the nation's ability to defend itself? But even more importantly, this is not the way to treat the men and women who have placed themselves on the line in defense of all of us. So at minimum, we would urge strongly, Mr. Chairman and Congresswoman, that you take the steps to start at least on the employment and training aspects, to start to pull together a group of public and private individuals to look for an action plan that is focused on things that are measurable, that can be done both by industry and by business organizations and by organized labor and by federal entities, and certainly with the leadership of the Congress. Once again, Mr. Chairman, I thank you very much for the opportunity to share these thoughts with you and the committee here today, and look forward to answering any questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I think each of you in your testimony have expressed opposition to Labor's proposal to blend the DVOPS and Leavers grant with other grants to the state. Let's talk about that a little bit more. I guess, you know, would anybody like to elaborate more on that? Again, that's one thing that it seems like we've got universal agreement or disagreement with, rather, from you all.
Mr. Chairman, if I can, the American Legion opposes the suggested changes that's been expressed, the opposition that's been expressed here this afternoon by everybody on the panel. What the American Legion opposes is the lack of oversight that will be provided in the states once this block grant is given to the governors and the decision is made within the state on how to distribute the funds for education. The American Legion wants the funds that are distributed to the states to be earmarked specifically for programs that will benefit employment programs for disabled veterans, hard-to-place veterans, any veterans who need that assistance through those programs to obtain gainful employment.
Uh,
The WIA Plus, in taking off all strictures that are now in Title 41 and not replacing that with hard metrics that would measure actual performance, is giving the states license. Some have suggested, there are some states like South Carolina, like South Dakota, I might add, where veterans priority service really does happen. But there are other states where it doesn't happen, and particularly the larger states, and where DVOPs and LVRs are already being used to serve non-veterans and to do clerical tasks that have nothing to do with helping the veterans whom they're there to serve. What WIA Plus would do is simply legitimize and make legal those abuses that are already happening. And in fact, what we need to do is stop the abuses and figure out a way to move to a different kind of system instead of legalizing the unlawful activity that is already taking place.
And just very briefly, veterans are, the responsibility for veterans, their care and assistance in job location is a national obligation. When you set earmarked funds into a block grant for governor's use, you essentially shift the responsibility to the discretion of the governor. Nothing wrong with all governor's discretion, but that should be local tax money for the governor, and it's we're concerned that veterans would be lost in the mix and that there would be little, if any, potential control from the federal side in the obligation that we have and the privilege we have to assist veterans in a seamless transition to the civil workforce.
I can share the remarks of my colleagues at the table here. One of the things that struck us was the language at the discretion of the governor. We firmly believe that, as I mentioned in my statement, that this could be the demise of the DVOP LVR program. If there is no controls, that money would be spent for the employment for a veterans. Thank you.
I just would reaffirm what Mr. Wideman made the point about priority of service. When we had a meeting with vets recently, I think the point that we tried to make, and there, I know there's been some efforts to readjust some of the proposals with regards to WIA Plus, but none of the proposals we have seen have reaffirmed the priority of service that exists for veterans in employment placement services. The Jobs for Veterans Act, which was passed out of this committee in the 107th Congress, reaffirmed that, and yet we think that that would throw the priority of service for veterans right out of the window. Furthermore, a complaint that we registered on a number of arenas when it comes to veterans is the fact that there is no accountability, and the WIA Plus doesn't hold governors or the states as a whole accountable for making sure that veterans receive that priority of service. And as long as that vacuum exists, there's no way that we could support this proposal.
Mr. Chairman, I know this is an oversight hearing on the Veterans Employment and Training Service, but may I say, sir, that it has to look at VETS as only one small part of the U.S. Department of Labor. And it's the Secretary of Labor who needs to be addressed on the issue of whether or not we're going to go at these things. Now, Employment and Training Administration and the Assistant Secretary there has always been the one who controls the lion's share of the money. The VETS, the $200 million, is a lot of money to us, but it's tiny in comparison to the money that goes through the Employment and Training Administration. It's not quite decimal dust, but it's very small in comparison with the Employment and Training Administration. But it's not enough, and they want the discretion. If the states were going to take care of their veterans at their discretion using other ETA monies, they would have already done so. But I only know of one state in the nation who's ever used non-veteran-specific monies for veteran-specific programs, and it only happened twice, and that was when we had everybody lined up, and I know that I was part of that. I know this system well, if I may suggest, Mr. Bozeman, from personal experience, having for 8 years, 8.5 years, served as a state veterans program administrator. And many of those people are wonderful people. Many of your DVETs are wonderful, capable people, but they have no cards to play. They have nothing short of the nuclear option that was mentioned before, that of recapturing the money back from the states. And politically, that's not going to happen. VETS is not going to take all of the money away from the governor of Arkansas for the VETS program or from the governor of South Dakota. It's not going to happen. And therefore, you're left with no teeth in the law. And we need other options that focus on a system of rewards and perhaps sanctions based on actual performance, which currently we don't have, sir.
Thank you. Ms. Herseth?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for your thoughts and your testimony, particularly as it relates to this whole issue of WIA Plus and what this could do. I share many of those concerns, and hopefully those concerns are shared by our colleagues in the other chamber as well as they're evaluating what may happen here. We certainly appreciate the ideas that you've offered and what we can do, making some legislative changes or addressing some of the budgetary issues that are important in improving the VETS service in the Department of Labor. And I know my working relationship with the chairman and certainly the dedication of all the staff for this committee and staff in our own offices, that we welcome your ideas, given your service to our veterans, implementing much of, you know, what goes on in these programs on the ground, to share those ideas and our ability to work together to get that done. In my opening statement, I made reference to the fact that I'm concerned with what appears to be a simultaneous demand for services, but yet level funding or relatively level funding in the budget requests for Department of Labor here. And I'm particularly concerned, especially for Operation Iraqi Freedom and Enduring Freedom veterans as they come home, that their first interaction with any program that's being administered on their behalf is a positive one, and that we have adequate resources and staffing needs to make sure that that first interaction experience is a positive one. And so based on your various groups' contact with some of these returning veterans, have you already started hearing from them about any frustrations, any complaints, any concerns with time delays, responsiveness in their efforts to seek opportunities in employment or reemployment?
I have not had a lot of calls coming directly from my office about somebody calling specifically saying that they have had a difficult time working with vets. I do have calls coming in about needing for me to find them a job. Unfortunately, we don't have that. But what I try to do is guide them in the right direction. And one of the things I do is talk about vets. In some cases, they have already tried vets. They've contacted them, but that did not result in employment. Now, that's not to say that that is all the time. I would like to get calls saying that everybody is doing a great job, but unfortunately, people don't do that. They only call when they got problems. And a lot of the times that some of the people that I'm getting calls from, they've had significant problems other than just finding employment, too, that they're dealing with. So it's that whole mix that has to be addressed. If I can just take it one step further, I mentioned in my statement that I'm getting a lot of calls from people who have retired from one job and are finding that they cannot make it on what they thought would be a substantial income in order to maintain their lifestyle. And I'm getting more calls than I would like to get from them.
If there's one concern that PVA's had, and I think I've emphasized this point a number of times, including in the testimony previously on the VOC rehab program, it's the administering of the DTAP services by vets. TAP is pretty pretty commonly gets done, for the most part, the way it's supposed to be done. But I would say that DTaP is definitely not as consistently administered. We keep hearing about the Iraq and Afghanistan veterans who are getting these services, and most of that is because they're coming through Walter Reed and Bethesda and a couple of facilities, as we talked about in a previous hearing. And they're getting all of the best services there, but there are a lot of young men and women who are at their home installations who are getting injured on active duty, not necessarily in the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, but also there are those who are returning to those installations and not necessarily just going to Bethesda or Walter Reed. And particularly the disabled men and women who are returning or who are at their stations are not getting the services that they want. And those are perhaps the individuals who are going to need those services the most, because they're not only going to face a challenge of their physical disability, but there are going to be automatic barriers that just happen to exist, both physical and psychological and other areas in trying to gain employment because of their disability that have just existed for a long period of time. And so I think we need to keep looking at the DTaP program, and I don't think we can emphasize enough the need to make sure that that program in particular is taking place. And I made that point about vet staff going out to the facilities where these disabled men and women are and giving those services if that is what is required. In most cases, particularly for PVA from PVA members' perspective, they're not able to get to the military installations where most of these services are being provided, and so the vet staff have to get out there to them.
If I may, first let me thank you for your concern for that new generation of veterans who are returning and are seeking employment with altered lives, with things that they're dealing with that they had no idea that they would have to deal with, be it amputation, mental health care. Thank you for your concern. And may I suggest that we readdress your specific point of how successful the VETS programs are being for that new generation of veterans as we continue in the global war on terrorism. I'm not saying we haven't been involved in this enough and there haven't been enough casualties and there haven't been enough returning veterans. What I am saying is to properly gauge the concern that you've raised over the successfulness of the VETS program for that new era of veterans. Task the VSOs to ask those DVOPs and LVERs that we have direct contact with to ask them specifically the numbers of returning veterans from OIF, OEF, and how successful they are being in even going to the VETS offices and asking for assistance and then receiving the assistance they need to integrate successfully back into the civilian workforce. I say back into when a lot of these soldiers and sailors and airmen and Marines that are returning have never had a civilian job. They're 19, 20 years old. They only know a job where they're wearing the uniform of this country. So I think we as VSOs, and I, again, appreciate your interest in this, can give you the information you need and should gauge that information in the next year or two.
3 points around this, if I may. First is we hear consistently about the inconsistency of TAP and DTAP. And perhaps seeking the assistance of Chairman Hunter and Ranking Member Skelton to require it be in the officer evaluation reports of base commanders that TAP be done correctly. It's not now. And so sometimes it's 3 hours and sometimes it's 3 days. And where it's done correctly, it's tremendous assistance. And same for DTAP. Unfortunately, for Guard and Reservists, it's done the least, just like medical care for Guard and Reservists, which is deeply concerned, the Guard and Reserve Caucus, and is very uneven, particularly once you get away from the flagpole. Two other things, if I may. I think that many people have tried and have to, on USERRA, or the reemployment rights, to get it right. But there have been a lot more complaints, and there haven't been proactive efforts, even though they were suggested 3 years ago to the Secretary about mailing out or working with the states to mail out to the unemployment tax lists to inform employers. If they know the law, they're much more likely to obey it, and you cut down on that. Secondly, is moving with real alacrity where there is violation. And frankly, one of the worst violators in this war, just like in the first Gulf War, is state and local government. The fact that the city of Columbus, Ohio, that a young man committed suicide because that issue couldn't be resolved in time is absolutely shameful. And from our point of view, that mayor needs to be held accountable at the polls, and other people up the line, not only in city government, but within the federal government, in the structure that is supposed to administer USERRA, somebody needs to be held accountable and explain why this took so damn long. And the third thing, if I may add, it is also the responsibility of the Veterans Employment and Training Service to play a role in the enforcement of veterans' preference. If you talk to the Office of Personnel Management, they say it's not their job. You talk to VETS, and they say it's not their job. We're looking for whoever it is wandering somewhere in the depths and the bowels of the federal bureaucracy in Washington, D.C., whose job it is to enforce veterans' preference. And without that, it is more in the absence, and it's a joke. Not that many people at this table and many fine people and the members of Congress and both sides of the Hill haven't tried, but we still do not have meaningful veterans' preference, and in fact, it is eroding even further today when it's needed the most by the young men and women returning home. Thank you, sir.
I have no further questions. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. One follow-up, just very quickly. Have each of you heard from DVOPs and leavers about being required to do non-vet work? You might.
Okay. We know that there's an increasing number of DVOPs and LVERs who are hired part-time, and the remainder of their time is directed at related employment services. In many instances, what we hear from these folks is that the secondary part-time is taking much more of their commitment than they've been tasked to do for DVOPs. If you follow me on this, that they're using less and less of their time to work on the DVOP and leaver opportunities, and more of their time because of the management of these part-timers to do things other than working for former military, to assist former military. So that we hear that, and it's a concern of ours. But in general, we're fairly well pleased with the current anecdotal stories that we hear about the successes of the DVOP and leaver programs. We would hope that there be an effort to establish more measurable outcomes so that, yes, we could boost the juice, the resources available to these folks. And, yes, we're concerned about the modest levels of appropriations over the years, but you really have to have something measurable for representatives of the United States to take back to their taxpayers and say, we're going to increase these services because they're effective. So we're looking for the boosted measures so that you can do the right thing for DVOPs and leavers, which is to increase their funding.
We have heard some accounts. It's not the norm, but we just heard isolated instances.
Mr. Chairman, in a meeting a month or so ago with some representatives of the National Association of State Workforce Agencies, some of the representatives there from different states voiced concern that staff in their offices who were DVOPs and leavers were being pulled away to serve other employment functions. And in a few cases, it was to the extreme that it was as if their veterans' employment responsibilities became secondary to the responsibilities they were being pulled away to do. So that's kind of hearing it straight from the horse's mouth from our perspective. And that to say that that concern was addressed from that organization particularly.
I would just reiterate what Carl and Jim have stated. Many DVOPs are, of course, members of the DAV, and during our midwinter conference in March, I heard a couple of anecdotes of similar types of use of DVOP time.
I can say the American Legion is hearing the same things. I just had a phone conversation yesterday afternoon and this morning from the same LVER expressing the same concerns or letting me know that the main focus of his job right now is not to get jobs for veterans. It's to make sure that the administrative support of the office is being taken care of. A lot of the other ancillary roles that office takes on are falling in his lap, and that's just one specific instance that I've heard just in the past couple of days. But it's I can't say it's a blanket problem nationwide, but it are our specific pockets where this is occurring.
If I may suggest, Mr. Chairman, it is a systemic problem. and it has been a problem for many years, but there was always the monitoring. As the what used to be called the Wagner-Peiser money, the money for the regular employment service has diminished every year since 1981 up through today. The pressure to utilize the disabled veteran outreach program specialists and local veterans employment representatives to serve non-vets and to do functions that don't have has grown every year. Has grown every year. So one, it's in some cases, in many cases, the office managers are not terrible people. They just are under such key pressure. They get fired if they have big problems with people management within the office, and people start, and it makes a scene over and over again and hits the local newspaper. They get fired if they don't pay unemployment insurance on time. Nobody gets hurt at all, and no office manager, because they didn't get a vet a job. And that is a systemic problem to the whole issue, and perhaps we need to look hard at the placing veterans specialist staff in there. Given the day of today where you can go anywhere with a laptop and you can do that supervision and you don't have to be at a desk in the corner of an office, perhaps it's time to revisit this model altogether, sir. Thank you.
Have you got anything else?
Just to follow up on, is this part of the reason that, I can't remember which one of you it was, and maybe it was more than one, suggested that we have a separate veterans one-stop? Because we have, and it isn't a problem all states. You've been complimentary to South Dakota, and I was just at the Northern Hills Career Center where that didn't seem to be the problem. And yet, if we've got the issue with the one-stop career centers, is that it's that type of environment in which it's more likely that the time and the resources are being diverted away from the veterans. I mean, is that, you kind of nodded that that was, you were agreeing with my statement. I'm sorry I'm not articulating it very well right now, but is this a concern you have about the one-stop career centers in particular?
I just want to express what Rick already brought up about the Wagner-Peiser Act and the reduction in funding for that. That reduction causes the offices to lean harder on the DVOPs and LVERs. The Wagner and Peiser Act is not being as effective as it should be. Therefore, they are almost forced to put more job responsibilities on the DVOPs and LVERs that aren't veteran specific. That office has a mission as an office, regardless of veterans needing jobs. Veterans needing jobs are the goal of the DVOPs and LVERs. But as an office, as a one-stop center as a whole, they're operating with their own requirements and goals that they need to achieve. And if they need to lean on the DVOPs and LVERs to achieve that overall mission of meeting their requirements of providing employment to non-veteran-specific individuals, that's what they're doing. And that's why you're seeing the DVOPs and LVERs doing more than just seeking or providing job opportunities for veterans, but doing more administrative role in the office and doing more widespread issues in that office.
It is the pressure, it's structural pressure in that sense. If you've got, you have your mortarman in an infantry platoon, but if you're down to half strength, everybody's going to do two or three jobs. And so some of it is from that point of view. The question is, do you need to do that anymore? And about keeping people in an office. Now, because of critical mass, you're not going to be able to do a veterans one-stop, I don't think, probably in South Dakota. You could in Little Rock, possibly in Fort Smith, but you couldn't in most of Arkansas because there's just not enough critical mass of returnees. What you could do is a variation on it, and when a Garden Reserve unit comes together, then it comes together in that community, involving members of that community, leaders of that community. And one of the things that is not inconsiderable that has never been truly studied by VETS or anybody else, I might add, is the corporate culture that exists in each and every state. In South Dakota, North Dakota, it's excellent towards veterans as getting priority. South Carolina, North Carolina, it's excellent. Veterans really get veterans' priority of service there. They get literally put to the head of the line in South Carolina. Many other states like Florida, frankly, I'm ashamed to say New York, Ohio, many other places, it really varies on the office manager, in some cases not at all. So, and because the DVET, the USDOL DVET, doesn't have many cards to play, and as was pointed out, their state counterpart, the State Veterans Program Administrator, often is powerless in regards to the office managers. Nobody's enforcing the law, and maybe that the only way to do it is to have a pull strategy based on actual performance measures and money to follow that right down to the local office or one-stop center.
Thank you all so much for your testimony and your insight. Like I say, you all are excused, and again, we certainly appreciate you all being here. Thank you very much. Our second panel is a diverse group comprised of Mr. Sigurd Nielsen from GAO, Ms. Marin Daly from the National Association of State Workforce Agencies, Mr. Wee Puriotis, I'm sorry, Wes. That was a typographical error where we had Wee, but with Puriotis at the back, he could, you know, you can kind of see that. You'd wonder that there might be a we in front, but I did better. Is Puriotis, am I correct in that? Is that closer? Okay, very good. Chairman of Wesley, Brown, and Bartle, an executive placement firm. And Ms. Daly from the State Workforce Agencies. Okay, let's go ahead and get started then with Mr. Nielsen.
Thank you, Chairman Boozman and Ranking Member Herseth, who just left, I guess. I'm pleased to be here today to talk about our preliminary observations on the status of implementation of some key provisions of the Jobs for Veterans Act. In particular, my testimony today addresses three aspects of the progress that Labor's Veterans Employment and Training Service has made in implementing changes affecting its key programs that have changed as a result of JVA. First, the separation of DVOPs and Leavers' roles and responsibilities. Second, VETS' performance accountability system for DVOP and Leaver staff. And third, VET system for monitoring DVOP and Leaver performance. First, with regard to the changed roles for DVOPs and Leavers, VETS has taken action to implement the changes to the DVOP and Leaver programs. Through its policy guidance letters and training, VETS has clarified the DVOP and Leaver's new functions and the use of part-time positions for DVOPs. According to their fiscal year 2005 state plans, states will have about 2,900 DVOP and Leaver staff. 23 states will use the new flexibility under JVA to have half-time DVOPs, who will comprise about 18% of the total DVOP staff. Some states plan to use half-time DVOPs extensively. For example, South Dakota plans to have 87% of its DVOPs be half-time. Labor officials acknowledge that integration of DVOP and Leaver staff into the one-stop centers has been a persistent challenge because of entrenched cultures. Yet integration is occurring in some locations. For example, one DVOP we interviewed said that the Veterans Program is highly integrated within the WIA program in her local one-stop, with both sharing case management responsibilities. In cases where there is little integration, one reason cited was that the other staff at the one-stops were not educated or trained on serving veterans. Second, with regard to the new performance system, VETS has implemented some JVA changes to the accountability system, but it's still in transition. Prior to JVA, performance measures placed more emphasis on process-oriented measures, measures that simply track services provided to veterans, and not on the employment outcomes achieved for veterans. Beginning on July 1, 2003, VETS adopted performance measures that are similar to those in WIA, or the Workforce Investment Act. The three WIA-based measures are veterans that entered employment, retention in employment at 6 months, and job seeker satisfaction. In addition, VETS tracked entered employment following receipt of staff-assisted services and entered employment following receipt of these of case management. Like WIA, placement and earnings data come from the Unemployment Insurance Wage Reporting System. VETS reported that the DVOP and leaver program met labor's goals for the entered employment rate of 58% for all eligible veterans in program year 2003. However, they fell short of their goal of 60% for the employment rate for disabled veterans, achieving only a 53% employment rate. VETS reported that they exceeded the employment retention goals, however. VETS officials told us that the measures will change again this July when VETS will adopt OMB's new common measures. While the new common measures afford some advantages over existing measures, the frequent shifts in focus have made it difficult to collect comparable data that can be used to establish a pattern of performance for the DVOP and leaver programs. As a result, VETS anticipates that it will take at least until July 2007 to collect the necessary trend data to establish the minimum standard for the entered employment rate that all states will be expected to meet. Finally, with respect to JVA's requirements to monitor the DVOP and leaver programs, VETS has shifted greater responsibility for monitoring program performance to the state level, and VETS' monitoring role continues to evolve from enforcer to partner in achieving state goals. In 2004, VETS reviewed all state plans and conducted on-site monitoring reviews of 20% of local offices in each state. Now that VETS has completed its first year under the new performance accountability system, it is unclear how it will use its monitoring results to improve DVOP and leaver program performance. VETS officials have not provided a consistent methodology to incorporate and analyze relative performance among the local offices, states, and regional offices. But VETS and ETA are working on sharing the results of monitoring efforts, coordinating corrective actions, and taking a joint approach to program oversight. Mr. Chairman, this concludes my prepared remarks, and I'll be happy to answer any questions you or Ranking Member Herseth may have.
Thank you, sir. Let's have Ms. Daly now. You can go ahead. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chairman Bozeman, Ranking Member Herseth. On behalf of the National Association of State Workforce Agencies, I thank the subcommittee for the opportunity to share information on the contributions of our members in strengthening the nation's economy by linking veterans to jobs. The members of our association constitute state leaders of the publicly funded workforce system, vital to meeting the employment needs of veterans through the Disabled Veteran Outreach Program and the local Veterans Employment Representative Program. Before sharing NASWA's recommendations on how to improve workforce services for veterans, I want to acknowledge the strong working relationship between NASWA and the Veterans Employment and Training Service. NASWA and VETS have worked together since the enactment of the Jobs for Veterans Act to ensure the newly developed regulatory requirements improve the administration of workforce programs and service to veterans. NASWA is grateful to VETS staff that have graciously donated time to communicate and listen to NASWA members throughout implementation of the Jobs for Veterans Act. NASWA members are committed to providing the highest quality workforce services to our nation's veterans, National Guard members, and reservists. The workforce system's top priority is assisting veterans and disabled veterans in particular in making the transition from the military to the workplace. Given this priority of service in our capacity as workforce program administrators, we've identified additional issues requiring congressional attention for improving workforce services, and the following are our recommendations. Congress should appropriate an additional amount for the DVOP and LVER programs proportionate to the increase in the number of veterans requiring service upon their return from ongoing conflicts and also to adjust for inflation. We recognize this subcommittee does not determine annual appropriations. However, we encourage you to urge your colleagues on the Appropriations Committee to fund this program adequately. I also encourage you to consider support for additional training funds dedicated to providing veterans the skills required for successful transition into the civilian workplace. The subcommittee should amend the Jobs for Veterans Act to transition the DVOP and LVER funding cycle from a federal fiscal year to a program year. Program year supports integration of VETS programs into the WIA and one-stop systems, which helps align funding, planning, and performance with the same cycle on which the one-stop partners operate. The subcommittee should set adequate state allocation funding levels. The new state funding formula under the Jobs for Veterans Act caused wide fluctuations to individual state funding, creating unintended inequities. Eligibility for the incentive award grants under the Jobs for Veterans Act should be expanded to include workforce system offices. The benefits of incentive awards for exemplary service to veterans by individual employees have been limited by conflicts with state law and state directives that could be eliminated by congressional action to expand eligibility to offices in addition to individuals. NASWA encourages the Department of Labor to improve and simplify its guidance to the workforce system on delivery of prioritized service to veterans. Although the Employment and Training Administration has provided workforce program administrators guidance on providing veterans prioritized service, it has not been promoted adequately and its importance has not been sufficiently relayed to some service providers. Under the Transitional Assistance Program, or TAP, designed to provide information and services to military personnel preparing to transition from military service to civilian careers, performance measures are restricted to veterans, defined as individuals who have already been discharged from military service. NASWA recommends the TAP performance measures include military personnel who have a definite date for discharge in the near future. NASWA believes Congress should reconsider the Jobs for Veterans Act provision requiring the Secretary of Labor to assign a director for veterans employment and training to each state. I know of no other federal workforce program requiring federal oversight staff stationed in each state. Finally, the President's National Hire Veterans Committee, established by the Jobs for Veterans Act, got off to a slow start, but now has an active membership of major business representatives. NASWA supports the committee's efforts to develop a national campaign to advise employers on the benefits of hiring veterans. The Hire Vets First campaign, established by the committee, is an excellent effort to inform employers and provide a connection to state and local workforce development resources. The committee has assured NASWA it will refer employers to state websites, local one-stop career centers, and the DVOP and LVER staff. We look forward to working with you and other members of this subcommittee and Congress to provide the necessary workforce services to our nation's veterans. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer your questions.
Thank you. Mr. Poriotis?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Ranking Member Herseth, when I was originally invited to testify, as you can see from my written testimony, before this panel on March 17th, St. Patrick's Day, I was so excited that I ran out and bought a green tie and tried to change my name to O. Poriotis. But my 85-year-old Greek father was so relieved to hear that the date was changed to May 12th that he said, "It's good that they changed the date and not your name." However, I'm equally pleased, Mr. Chairman, to be here today, May 12th, which, as any good New Yorker should be able to tell you, is the 80th anniversary of the birth of one of our nation's great unsung intellectuals and philosophers, Lawrence Peter Berra, better known in many circles as Yogi Berra. So let me start by saying, in the words of Yogi Berra, that testifying before you today feels like deja vu all over again. So, Mr. Chairman, this is the third time since 2002 that I've had the honor to sit at this table to testify on ways to enhance the federal government's role in helping veterans secure quality employment opportunities. 11 years ago, at the request of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, I produced a report analyzing how veterans were faring in their transition from the military to civilian employment, especially in overcoming deselective biases in accessing and competing on a level playing field for the quality opportunities in the non-defense sector, the growth sectors of our economy. Sadly, at that time, I found that veterans' employment and career transition services were inadequate and outdated. Based upon a scientific survey and other research, I made almost a dozen recommendations to the Joint Chiefs on how to improve federal veterans' employment programs. Furthermore, I founded the Center for Military and Private Sector Initiatives, the 501c3, to help pursue implementation of those recommendations and other initiatives to improve employment prospects for transitioning military veterans and their families, how to market them, how to brand them, how to create a pull and overcome the push that now exists in most employment circles. Unfortunately, what I'm about to report in terms of the sorry state of federal veterans employment programs may sound to you like the Yogi Berra comment, deja vu all over again. In the decades since I gave the Joint Chiefs my recommendations and personally met with the President to address this issue, VETS has made some reforms, improved some services, and expanded its budget. But at the end of the day, it is still a fair characterization to say that the Veterans Employment and Training Service neither employs, nor trains, nor adequately services veterans' employment needs. Mr. Chairman, the problem at its core is that VETS is a government program trying to succeed in the private sector with government solutions. Let me give you a perfect example. Last week, the chairman of the President's National Hire Veterans Committee testified about the accomplishments of his committee. I have read his statement carefully, and here's what I found. In the 2.5 years since the committee was authorized, the only measurable achievement he could enumerate was the signing of 28 Hire a Veteran Month proclamations by state governors, with another 15 proclamations to be signed at the end of June this year. That's how government approaches the problem: create a committee, sign a proclamation. Let me share how the private sector approaches this same problem. After a year of planning, together with General Tommy Franks and Roger Chapin, the founder of A Salute to America's Heroes, we brought 138 of the most severely wounded in the war on terrorism and their families, free of charge to them, to Orlando and Disney World for a three-day retreat, conference, and work session to help them on their road to recovery. In addition to numerous programs to heal their spirit and provide them with tangible and material assistance, we presented them with houses and we refurbished their houses, as an example. We organized a comprehensive program to meet and provide employment navigation and counsel with each and every military service member and his or her spouse, because often it's not so much the military member acquiring the job, it's often the spouse who's more eligible for employment and can bring in the dollars to the home, and we should focus on them. Our program utilized what we call a working group, and I think we should take note of this, hero coach counselors and job developers, especially for disabled veterans. They go into the veteran's home, determine a career track, meet with local employers to literally get the veteran an interview. What we've missed here in all of this, in all of these programs, we have to get the veteran an interview. The hero coach counselor, in some cases, helps in the negotiation, the closing, and in essence, becomes the champion for the veteran payload to the employment target. This combination of experienced employment navigation plus the actual employer relationship building and opening up of what I call the hidden job market, the quality job market, the growth job market, goes through the pain of placement, which is the true pain that the VETS, DVOPs, and ELVRs avoid. And it's not because they avoid it, it's just that they're not tasked to do it. While we were meeting individually with these brave men and women, 20 vets representatives were in another room doing what they are tasked and trained to do: hand out written information, refer veterans to websites, and check off the boxes on their to-do lists. Mr. Chairman, I don't blame the men and women in the field working as ELVRs and DVOPs. They are doing the job they were assigned. Some of them are remarkable, caring, compassionate, and effective people. Yet, as Mr. Widener said earlier, they have no hard metrics upon which their performance is judged. Unemployment and the immeasurable yet omnipresent underemployment has reached such unacceptable proportions that someone like Jim Nicholson, the new Secretary of VA, recently met with me at the request of several corporate executives to hone in on the 24% unemployment for young veterans. He, even though he's not statutorily responsible for employment, labor is spending an enormous amount of time marketing and aggressively trying to open up doors for veterans. He said that he would spend his time with corporate executives to market and influence the influencers to make a real market in this growth economy for jobs for veterans. Unfortunately, this contrasts dramatically with vets leadership, who are so busy with their internal meetings, their internal discussions, that they can't get out of their own way to meet the enemy. And the enemy is corporate America, who basically, as was said in the former panel, are deselective by the nature there's been a distancing between the military and them. They're not naturally inclusive of this military as a workforce. In August of 2003, Jack Welch's successor, Jeff Immelt, spent 2.5 hours with us. We invited vets leadership to come with us. They were too busy to come. Immelt basically said he would bring other corporate executives together and have his own human resources team bring other HR folks together to really influence the influencers in the hiring community to bring these veterans and this valuable asset across the table. The fact is, we can never solve a private sector problem with government approaches and programs. Yogi Berra again said, it ain't over till it's over. But respectfully, Mr. Chairman, in the case of vets with regard to quality employment, opportunities, career advancement, I believe its time is over. One of America's most important entrepreneurs recently gave a remarkable speech on education at a summit meeting of our nation's governors. Bill Gates minced no words. American high schools are obsolete. By obsolete, I don't just mean that our high schools are broken, flawed, or underfunded. By obsolete, I mean that our high schools, even when they are working exactly as designed, cannot teach our kids what they need to know today. Mr. Chairman, we merely need to substitute Mr. Gates' words on obsolete high schools with the obsolete Veterans Employment and Training Service. Rather than reforming and coping with an obsolete federal agency, we need to seriously develop a blueprint that reconsiders the entire notion of government-sponsored programs to help veterans get jobs in the private sector. If Mr. Gates can be so blunt in crying out for a redesign, we can do no less for our veterans. We need to evaluate the efficacy of outsourcing the vet's function, or at least significant parts of that function. An outsourced entity would be mandated to carry the veterans' employment football across the goal line. At present, the veterans' employment payload is simply not meeting the target. It's like a boxer who moves deftly, jabs, throws powerful uppercuts, but never actually hits his opponent. Unless we can task people to go out and find the hidden job market among private sector employers, we will never succeed. Until they are measured by how many jobs they find for veterans rather than how many daily tasks they perform, success will continue to elude us. At the very least, I would recommend that this committee authorize pilot programs that allow the private sector to infuse its knowledge and energy into the noble task, and I say it's noble, of finding high-quality jobs for the men and women who have so honorably worn the uniform. To create jobs, we need to unleash the talent and creativity of the private sector. Similarly, if we want to find quality, new and existing jobs, we also need to unleash the private sector. And Mr. Chairman, in my closing remarks, and thank you for letting me go over, I thought about Teddy Roosevelt's famous political barnstorming, often called the bully pulpit. We need to be bold and reach out for a head of vets like Jack Welch, Dick Grasso of the New York Stock Exchange, Payne Weber's Joe Grano, Lou Gerstner of IBM fame, somebody that has the corporate juice, who can influence the influencers and get his peers to come to the table on this issue. Let the able administrators within vets do what they do ably, and that's administer. But for a dollar in salary and the capacity to leave a personal legacy for infusing the treasure of military service into the American business bloodstream, We can recruit a passionate corporate leader to head vets and forge a bully pulpit for veterans' employment. It's quite probable. Let me close, Mr. Chairman, with one of my favorite yogiisms. When you come to a fork in the road, take it. So to put that another way, the Veterans Employment and Training Service is done. Stick a fork in it, move on, and let's create a new public-private partnership to help veterans actually get quality jobs.
Thank you very much. Mr. Nielsen, you mentioned in your testimony that the DVOP and Leaver program had been reported to meet their goal of 58%.
Yes.
Is that correct?
That's correct.
How do you know? One of the criticisms from the other panel was that basically, you know, whenever anybody fills out a form, then if they get a job and go forward, that they're considered as, you know, hired through that program. Can you respond to that criticism?
Yes, that is true. We don't know exactly why that person got that job. I think there are a couple things. One, you need good measures on a program to know what's happening with the people flowing through that program. One of the things that was said on the earlier panel was when WEA was passed in 1998, they did away with registering everybody who comes through the door of a one-stop. Our work, we've done extensive work on the Workforce Investment Act, and we, GAO, has recommended that they go back to registering everybody who comes through the door so that you know what you're measuring when you go out the door. Because right now you can manage those outcomes very easily by determining and selecting who you register for services and then later determine when you decide to exit them. The common measures that's being put into effect this coming July also will require that everybody be registered. With that, you will know who is serving all veterans who come through a one-stop, because not all veterans are served by DVOPs and leavers. Many people come through a one-stop, get a job through either self-directed services at a one-stop or because of services from somebody else in the one-stop. In order to be able to assess that a veteran got a job because of the assistance that was provided to them, you need to conduct a rigorous evaluation of the program. You can't do it with performance measures. Performance measures are indicators, but you need a rigorous evaluation to determine what kind of services veterans got, and what happened as a result, and compare them to what would happen without those kinds of services. So it's a long way of saying there are two issues. One, you have to know what's happening to everybody who come through the door. Secondly, you need to do an evaluation, perhaps in conjunction with the Employment Training Administration, to see what's happening to everybody who comes through the door in a one-stop and why. What outcomes did they achieve, and what were the services that were provided? So you can associate services with outcomes.
I agree. I mean, it looks to me like you'd have to look at you know, if nothing were done, you just basically writing your name on a sheet of paper. If nothing were done, you know, there would be some employment that took place, mm-hmm. you know, and then compare that rate with the rate that's, you know, is actually published. And, I mean, like I said, that to me is pretty basic. Then you really know what that group is actually doing, you know, versus the other. I don't know how hard it would be to estimate, you know, the amount of employment, like I say, if the program didn't exist. But that really does need to be done. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you agree?
Yes, I do.
Very much. In your testimony, Mr. Poriotis, in the testimony about Ms. Daly concerning inadequate funding, excessive oversight for the DVOP Leaver program, reduction of services for veterans, and yet we constantly hear about the DVOPs and veterans being tasked by local managers to do non-veterans' tasks.
On behalf of NASWA, we recognize the concern regarding DevOps and LVERs occasionally performing services in one-stop environments not directly related to service for environments for veterans. But we'd understand these instances to be limited and, when identified, immediately addressed to ensure full attention is provided to the veterans. So as we have explored this issue, we have found it to be more limited in nature than to be a massive problem. We do not believe these limited situations detract from the need for adequate funding for the DVOP or LVER programs. State allocations under these programs have increased by approximately $3.9 million in 8 years. This amount represents just over 1 year's increase in inflationary costs. We also have a major concern with the funding for training for veterans. The Veterans Workforce Investment Program, the funding dedicated to training for veterans, has been flat funded over 5 years. Last year, $7.5 million served only 12 states. The workplace our veterans return to today is totally different than the one of 20, 10, or even 5 years ago. Veterans, in many cases, require more training and skills than non-veterans to maintain their competitiveness in a dynamic workplace. NASWA is a partner with the administration in its high-growth job training initiative, and this effort is to make the system more proactive in responding to the workforce needs of businesses and understanding the workload as DevOps and LVERs become stronger advocates for veterans in searching out opportunities in high-growth businesses. So in summary, Mr. Chairman, we recognize this to be a problem limited in scope, readily addressed, and yet there are increasing needs for servicing of veterans that require increase in funding, both on the staffing side for DevOps and LVERs, and particularly on the training side, to enable our veterans to step into good careers in today's economy.
Mr. Poriotis, you, in your testimony, talked about what's needed. What kind of attributes, what type of individual would you consider appropriate to be the next ASVET?
I think you have to have someone who's taken a moribund, lethargic organization and rebranded it. I mean, we failed to remember often that when Lou Gerstner took over IBM, it was next to be broken up. The board of directors of IBM wanted to break it up and sell it off in pieces. He saw that that one entity with the power of rebranding itself to its customers would thrive again, and now he's a legend. So I think someone has to have the passion. They have to also obviously have the ego to have gotten to such a senior role in the first place. When you think of people like Jack Welch, who basically, when he took over General Electric, they called him, you know, Nuclear Jack, because he basically was decimating the organization and he rebuilt it from scratch. I'd say that the characteristics are a passion to leave a legacy, and we need to take their energies and efforts. When last May I brought 15 corporate executives in front of the House Veterans Affairs Committee to speak to the value of military service, because I firmly believe that regardless of the money you throw at vets, regardless of the resources you add to it, unless there's the passion, unless there's the rebranding of military service as valuable to the non-defense growth sector, that we will be back here 10 years from now talking about the same thing. So, in direct answer to your question, someone who's taken a brand, and military service is a brand that has lost its value. It's lost its equity, as the consumer packaged goods and advertising people say. I brought 20 chairmen and CEOs of advertising agencies together, people who brought Pepsi to the marketplace, people who brought, you know, Louis Vuitton and BMW, and I said, take military service. Think of it as a brand. How would you relaunch it to the private sector? And one of the people there ran the Volvo account for a major agency. He said, let me ask you a question. You want to buy a Volvo because why? And most of the advertising folks knew immediately, because it's safe. So equity in the brand is that it was safe. You want to hire a military person or a veteran, why? You know, we use all the intangibles. They're great, they have leadership, they have quality, they have integrity. But the American employer outside the defense sector and the governmental entity want to hire them because it adds to the P&L and to the bottom line. We haven't rebranded military service toward that goal. So I would try to induce a CEO like a Jack Welch or a Gerstner or a Joe Grano. They're worth hundreds of millions. They're doing nothing now. A few boards, playing a little golf, and their egos are so big they don't even fill this room. Let's rechannel that, get them to drive this to their peers. And I would say passion, rebuilding that brand, and the desire to leave a legacy.
Thank you. Ms. Herseth?
Let me just start as a follow-up then, Mr. Poriotis. I appreciate your testimony. I appreciate your passion on this issue. So let me just ask a couple of questions here. First, on this whole issue of injecting the private sector, would you agree with the testimony of the prior panel that it might help to assess the corporate culture in each state? Because some are better than others, that will help us then whether there's a move toward branding military value. I mean, don't we have to first have this assessment? Because I don't know that across the board we've got the folks that are quite as passionate about you in terms of the role that's going to be played. And I understand exactly what you're saying in terms of what we deal with in a government program and how expansive they can be and how people are managing their time, and clearly the consistent testimony today about a lack of measures for performance that can lead to the accountability that all of us desire here. But would you agree that some assessment of the corporate culture is required?
Congresswoman Herseth, can you imagine in the private sector to spend $200 million with an entity, a business unit, and they not have done any corporate perception audits to determine the behavioral blockages or where the good, bad, and the ugly are? I don't think they need more money. They need to rechannel the money based on where the problems are. We don't even know where the problems are. So, yes, Mr. Widener hit upon the difference between the Carolinas, Ohio, and Florida in terms of, but we haven't done a definitive perception audit. The first thing one would do in a behavioral analysis is to hold focus group sessions with three levels of management. So we have to get inside that management, have one-on-ones with corporate executives. We have to use the Society of Human Resources Management with their 200,000 human resources executives, connect with them and find out how they perceive military service. Right now, I would think that in the non-defense sector, if they perceive it, they perceive it at all as being those folks in a silo who defend us, but we're not going to bring them across the threshold to high-quality opportunity with career mobility. It's the other amazing part of the perception lack is the fact that we don't know where the 4 million are who've evolved into the first Gulf War. When I asked Mr. Jaworski, the head of vets last year, I said, where are they? He said, well, we're doing that. I said, where are those you've placed? We don't have an alumni network. Any good college would have an alumni network. We don't have a network of those with former military service background in business so that we could link the individual coming out immediately with somebody in that particular field. And secondly, to add one little sidebar, the Army is having a terrific time now recruiting folks. I say every time a person comes in to be recruited, he or she is connected with someone in the private sector as an external mentor. They may not work there, but at least it guides them through. And right now, they could equate the 4, 5, or 7 years of service with the equivalent of a baccalaureate and the equivalent of private sector platform after service. It's we have a terrific problem because nobody's approaching this with the intelligence of a business.
And you make a number of interesting points, creative points, and I do agree that the business community, the business environment, can allow us important lessons in instructing how we go about to meet these types of performance measures to create them and then meet those standards. And one of the, going back though to the whole issue of the perception of employers, whether they're large corporations, whether they're small and mid-sized business. I would just say that part of what the recent GAO report here, Mr. Nelson, on employers being aware of certain programs, one-stop career centers, we do have to make this transition of just employers being aware of a program, aware of a service, to what more data do we need in terms of what's driving the employer's decisions here? And I think that gets exactly kind of a step further under the surface of what are their employers' perceptions then of the different clientele that the one-stop career centers are servicing. So I just want to make that comment before asking one other question to you. And let me see where I made my notes there. I may have tied it in, actually, with some of my comments here. But the other issue I want to get at is the Internet services that are being incorporated. Has there been any integration of a tracking or monitoring system, any other measure as more and more individuals, and in our case here specifically veterans, are using the Internet through the one-stop career centers? I mean, even though we're lacking a performance measure, has anything been done in terms of that service to track and monitor that's different from when someone comes in physically to the one-stop career center location?
I think that varies by state. Many states don't want to, if people are accessing services through the Internet, many states don't want to be an impediment by requiring people to register, put in a Social Security number so then they can track them. What most states, it's my impression, do is sort of track hits on their websites. But they feel sometimes that if they require people to register, they're going to discourage people from using the service.
And if
so not many states do that.
And if you realize how a talent acquisition operation works in a major corporation, they may have 150 to 300 recruiters. Most of the low-level recruiters who are tasked to fill positions will use Monster Board, Hired, you know, jobs.com, Career Builder. But you're still begging the question. The Vice President of Human Resources has to be confronted and brought to Jesus on the value of military service. The problem with the one-stop and the vets operations, they're not inside the strategic tents when the talent acquisition strategy is being made. Those vice presidents make the talent acquisition strategy in the first of the year. And you know what? If you're not in the strategic tent when they're determining which colleges they're going to, which workforce organizations they're going to go to, you're overlooked. I talked to 12 human resources vice presidents before my last testimony. They had either never heard of vets, or when they had called them, couldn't get serviced in a useful manner, or three didn't think of military service as being valuable to their workforce because they had never understood the theoretical translation of the background, not just the literal translation.
Okay, I appreciate that. Again, we'll have to have more meetings with you to pick your brain on some other, and you're coming at a very interesting angle, and I think we have a lot more to discuss. I know Mr. McWilliam is waiting to testify too, and I've gone over my time, but just one last question for you. Based on your testimony, because we're going to be asking our next witness a little bit more as a follow-up to the President's Hire Veterans Committee, in your opinion, would it be preferable then to just let that committee expire and allow for more direct interaction, work with the private sector to encourage greater links between employers and service members?
I don't think the committee knows what marketing is. I do think that it's misspent a lot of money. I'll tell you why. They think their job, based on the last testimonies, to connect the one-stop centers and the government with but they're not getting inside the brains and the portfolios of corporate America and inducing them to bring this over the threshold by their own desires. They're speaking to the converted, not to the unconverted, and I don't think they're using their committee members well.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Again, thanks to the panel. We appreciate your testimony. Appreciate your ideas and comments. Our next panel is Mr. John McWilliam, which we really do appreciate coming over and testifying before us, Deputy Assistant Secretary for Operations and Management, Veterans Employment and Training Service Department of the Labor. You're recognized, Mr. Williams. McWilliam.
Thank you, sir. Chairman Bozeman and Ranking Member Herseth. The Veterans Employment and Training Service has the mission of providing veterans with the resources and the services to succeed in the 21st century workforce. We do this by maximizing their employment opportunities, protecting their employment rights, and meeting labor market demands. Our budget request for fiscal year 2006 totals $224,334,000 and covers the Jobs for Veterans state grants, the Homeless Veterans Reintegration Program, the Veterans Workforce Investment Program, Federal Administration, which includes our federal workforce of 250 positions, transition services to the military community, and the protection of service members' reemployment rights, and the National Veterans Training Institute for the training of professionals in veterans employment and training. Mr. Chairman, under the Jobs for Veterans state grants, funds are made available to each state upon the approval of a state plan to support the DVOP and LVER programs. Our fiscal year 2006 budget supports 2,334 DVOPs and LVERs located in the one-stop career centers. In program year 2003, the Public Labor Exchange performance measure had an entered employment rate for veterans of 58%. This means that over 700,000 veterans entered employment through these services. The Homeless Veterans Reintegration Program provides grants to operate employment programs that reach out to homeless veterans. As I testified last week, this is an extremely successful program with marked success. The Veterans Workforce Integration Program offers programs designed to provide intensive services to veterans with employment barriers. Our 2006 request will support a program of 17 grantees serving 2,500 participants. Since 1990, when the Department of Labor began providing Transition Assistance Program workshops, over 1 million separating and retiring military members have been provided job preparation assistance. This program is a partnership between the Departments of Labor, Defense, Homeland Security, and Veterans Affairs. We have been working with the National Guard and the Reserve on providing transition services to returning service members in many states. Our state directors coordinate with returning unit commanders to offer employment workshops at home sites that are uniquely tailored for the intended audience. Our goal is to provide transition assistance at every location requested by the Armed Services and the Department of Homeland Security. Last October, Secretary Chao set out to help America's wounded and injured service members when she launched Recovery and Employment Assistance Lifelines. Real Lifelines provides wounded and injured service members and their families with personal assistance to prepare them for rewarding careers. We currently have representatives at Walter Reed and Bethesda Medical Centers, Fort Lewis, Washington, and Fort Sam Houston, with other locations to include medical holding companies to follow. The Department of Labor is also a key participant in the recently established Defense Military Severely Injured Joint Support Operations Center. Mr. Chairman, the use of the Guard and the Reserve has increased dramatically in recent years, and the Department of Labor administers and enforces the Uniformed Services Employment and Reemployment Rights Act. The Department of Justice and the Office of the Special Counsel are also charged with enforcing this act. Mr. Chairman, the Department of Labor leads a workforce investment system that provides veterans and other job seekers with access to training so that they can gain the skills demanded by employers and succeed in the labor market. We look forward to continuing to work with the committee as we serve those who have served. I will be pleased to respond to your questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. McWilliam. We do appreciate you coming over. We're a nation at war, and, you know, you've got a big job, and then we've got a big job, you know, in helping you do your job. And I think that I can speak for myself and the ranking member and the people on this committee that we really are totally committed to, you know, providing you the resources to take care of our veterans. Let's get back a little bit. You know, we mentioned the Title 38 requiring the vets to submit an annual report. Hadn't really gotten one since 2000. Can you tell us a little bit about that, you know, as to who decided to skip the reporting requirement, and you know, are we going to get the 2001, 2002, 2003, 2004 reports?
Mr. Chairman, I do not believe there was a conscious decision not to submit a report. There was a time of turmoil. The reporting system had changed. The reporting performance measures have changed over the last several years, and I believe the report was just never compiled and submitted. We recognize that this year. We've been working very hard to submit the report. We now have the data. We are just about to put it into departmental clearance and to submit it then to the committee. We are committed to submitting this report. It does go back and cover the missing years for which a report was not submitted.
Would it help if we amend Title 38 to split the reporting due dates to better conform to the program year and fiscal year cycles?
Mr. Chairman, I believe it would help to change the time frame, perhaps to the May time frame, to allow for the clearance procedures. We'd very much like to work with the committee to establish an exact date for that.
The other thing is, you know, we talked on all the previous two panels a little bit about really the accountability measures for you really to understand what's going on. And I think we are spending a lot of money, you know, in trying to help our veterans and things. And maybe we need to spend more. Maybe we need to do a better job, you know, of the monies that we're spending. But it is difficult. You know, we've got a goal, you know, that we're going to reach, and you're actually reaching that goal. And yet, when you really think it through, to me, that goal really doesn't mean anything. Like I said, we don't really know what the outcome would be if we just signed a sheet of paper versus, you know, the people in the field actively, you know, pursuing, trying to work, getting people employed. Can you respond to that? I mean, is that something that you would pursue to try and get us a for real feeling? And then also, I would like that broken out by kind of state. You know, maybe not state, regions, some areas of the country. You know, we've got a greater concentration of returning vets. Maybe there's reasons that we're having problems in some part of the countries because we don't have facilities there or whatever. But what I'd like to know is where the hot spots are that are not doing well. And then the other thing is where the areas are that we're doing really good job. One of the things I'm committed to, and I think the ranking member also, is to try and get together best practices so that, you know, people can benefit, you know, from the things that are working.
Mr. Chairman, we do have results by state, and we can certainly provide that to the committee. We have a very comprehensive performance accountability system, and if I may describe it for a moment, it starts with the state plan. The state plans have six performance measures at the Public Labor Exchange, and those are the ones we've been discussing with earlier panels. For instance, 58% entered employment for all veterans going through there. There's also 17 negotiated measures at the state grant level, which is at the DVOP and the LVER level. And this is very specific. It starts with entered employment for all veterans who receive services, all veterans who are in the Career One Stop, but then it includes enter employment for after receiving staff-assisted services, entered employment after receiving case management services, and then retain employment. We do that for all veterans. We do that for the disabled veterans, and we also do a subset for the newly separated veterans. So there are 17 performance measures that are viewed. These are negotiated on a state-by-state level with our state director and the State Workforce Administration. On a quarterly basis, this information is reported through our state directors to the regional directors to our national office. We look at this very closely. Anything that's outside a tolerance of, I believe, plus or minus 5% requires a risk analysis to be done and a corrective action to be looked at. We provide technical assistance to that one stop or to that state to make those corrections. There's also a quarterly manager's report, Mr. Chairman, that is presented that identifies items such that we've been talking about today, such as use of the veterans' representatives not to service veterans, and it also identifies best practices. Those best practices are identified to the state workforce agencies so that they can be used in other agencies.
Also, there was concern about block granting. I was on the school board for 7 years, you know, prior to coming to Congress, and we had great concern in that regard, in the sense that many of the states, as you know now, are struggling to keep their head above water, and there's a tendency to kind of shift things around. And I know we've got some safeguards in and this and that, you know, you're not supposed to do that. But the reality is, and I think that we could, you know, come up with all kinds of examples, that because of the, you know, the fiscal constraints of the state, those things happen. Is that a concern for you as far as that scenario?
Mr. Chairman, we are very concerned that under WIA Plus, that veterans continue to receive priority of service and continue to achieve the performance goals that we have. We do think it's an advantage that there would be an additional potential of $3.2 billion in training dollars available to veterans, and also for which they would receive priority of service within the one-stops. As you mentioned, the performance measures would still remain in place. State plans would still have to be produced and submitted. We have worked with the Employment and Training Administration to assure that the vets would be part of that negotiation of those performance measures for the state plan and also in reviewing the performance under those state plans. Mr. Chairman, our Deputy Assistant Secretary Tom Dowd from our Employment and Training Administration is here today if the committee would like to ask any further questions concerning WIA Plus.
The other thing that was mentioned, I think that's valid, is that we really don't, and you can correct me, but we really don't have a handle as far as, but we don't have a club short of just withdrawing the funds. Do we need to give you some authority or whatever to spank hands a little bit before we and get more and more aggressive, where you really do have some ability to make sure? You can't tell me that there's not, you know, somebody amongst the 50 states abusing what we're talking about. You know, there's no ifs, ands, or buts. You know, it's happening someplace. When we find that or whatever, you know, do we need to have greater flexibility if we see that not, you know, really done in a systemic way versus, you know, an accidental way or whatever? Do we need to give you the ability to come down on them and whatever? You understand what I'm saying.
I do, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much. And we'd very much like to talk to the committee about those issues. We think perhaps that might be tied to the incentive awards program, and we would like to talk to the committee about that because it's not being used by 29 of the states for various reasons. They're not able to participate in that or have decided not to participate in that. We have found at this point, Mr. Chairman, that by providing technical assistance on the quarterly review of the reports that we receive, that we're able to influence the states to achieve their performance.
Thank you. Ms. Herseth?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mr. McWilliam. Let me start out with something that happened last year. The appropriations committees in both the House and the Senate issued parallel instructions to the Department of Labor regarding several veterans' employment and training programs in various topics, including adding a module on homelessness prevention to the TAP curriculum, outstationing of DVOP and leavers to the HVRP grantee sites, and implementing the Jobs for Veterans Priority of Service mandate. So if you could talk just generally about the steps the department's taken in implementing the instructions, and then specifically, has the department issued guidance to state workforce agencies about the outstationing of DVOPs and leavers in locations where homeless veterans congregate? And does the Department of Labor plan to issue formal and promulgate formal regulations rather than just issuing the guidance letters on the priority of service mandate with the Jobs for Veterans Act?
Thank you, ma'am. Let me, on the addressing homelessness in the TAP workshops, we are working with Department of Defense and Department of Veterans Affairs through the TAP steering group to add that. We have not decided yet, the group has not decided yet on what form that needs to take and how to address that, but we will keep the committee informed on how that goes forward. We do provide guidance when we issue guidance on the state plans for the states about the outstationing of DVOPs. Currently, there are 34 DVOPs who are spend a substantial portion of their time at HVRP grantees. On priority of service, we have issued administrative notices to the states concerning how priority of service is to be implemented within each of the DOL-funded programs. I do not know if we have a position on publishing regulations, ma'am, but we will provide that information to you.
Well, I think that's particularly important because while much of the testimony today and my position being inclined to oppose the block grants because of concern that would have, but your response to the chairman was, well, if that were to happen under WEA Plus with the block grants, we would have certain things in place as it related to priority of service. But if it's only administrative notice, I mean, it has to be a formal regulation, in my opinion. Now, I hope that this doesn't happen, as I said, but in the event that it does, it highlights the importance of having those regulations in place beyond the guidance letters, beyond the administrative notice. Now, I have two more questions. If you could elaborate on efforts that VETS has made to provide outreach to returning National Guard and Reserve personnel, particularly maybe in coordination with state National Guard and Reserve leaders in South Dakota. I feel that we've been very proactive in doing that and coordinating even at the demobilization sites in many respects. But could you elaborate on the efforts the Department of Labor has taken?
Certainly, ma'am. Thank you. And South Dakota certainly is a good example. We have a very proactive DVET state director there. We have instructed and asked all our state directors to make contact with the state adjutants general to ask exactly what kind of services they feel that they need to be provided to returning service members. We provide a representative of every demobilization site who gives a short class on USERRA, on the Employment and Reemployment Rights Act, and on mentioning that the transition services that are available for returning service members. I believe that that covers it. As I said, we will send a representative to every demobilization site, and pardon me, at the same time, we will also offer to the unit commanders to then provide a much more extensive transition assistance program when the unit has the next drill or can have a period of time. I know in some cases in South Dakota, they actually put people on orders and send them to TAP down at Fort Carson so they can participate.
That's right. And I'm glad you said what you said just a minute ago in terms of the next drill, you know, after that, because the follow-up here is so important. And these folks are getting back. They just want to get through where they are to get home to their families. So if we can have that ongoing outreach, that proactive attitude toward reaching out to the service members that are returning. My last question takes us back to the President's National Hire Veterans Committee. In response to one of my questions last week, during the subcommittee's legislative hearing, you stated that the committee is being funded through the DVOP and Leaver grant program resources. However, I'd like you to just clarify the stream of money here, because when I look at the record, the House of Representatives record, May 20th, 2002, the report of this committee, as well as a joint explanatory statement on Senate amendments to House amendments on H.R. 4015, and I'm going to read that section for you. It's unclear to me that there's authority to fund the committee in such a manner. It reads, this section, meaning Section 6, would authorize $3 million to be appropriated to the Secretary of Labor from the Employment Security Administration account of the Unemployment Trust Fund for each of the fiscal years 2003 through 2005 for the President's National Higher Veterans Committee. So could you just clarify if that money is actually being taken out of that account and then put over into the grant resources for the DVOPs and leavers and then to the committee, or how is that working exactly?
Ma'am, the appropriation that we receive each year is from the account that you just mentioned, and it is to fund the activities that are identified in Chapter 41 of Title 38, which includes the President's National Higher Veterans Committee. So I think I think perhaps the best approach to this, I believe we had contact with members of your staff, and I think we need to have a meeting to sit down and fully explain it. I believe one is scheduled for next week, ma'am, to understand this.
Okay, if we can just get some clarification, it just comes down to the importance of the accountability that the chairman had mentioned at the outset, as well as in addition to getting fully briefed on this particular component, also a more specific financial sheet that we had requested as well in terms of the expenses and how the expenditures are being made and targeted.
Yes, ma'am. We've been working on that. We just about have that ready and Great. Should put it into clearance to submit to the committee within the next several days.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Just a couple things real quick. The Jobs for Veteran Act requires priority of service for veterans, not only for jobs, but in the DOL training programs. Has VETS established training goals for each program? If so, you know, what are they? Does VETS or the Department of collect data on the number of veterans enrolled in the DOL training programs? Does the data reflect any relativity to the number of veterans seeking training and employment in a given area?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I said, we have provided guidance to everyone in all the programs funded by Department of Labor on what priority of service means. We do accumulate the data on how many veterans are present in the population that's being serviced by that program, and we will include that in our annual report, a description of the priority of service within the various programs funded by Department of Labor.
Thank you. One last thing, and again, this is kind of a follow-up to what we were talking about earlier. The Jobs for Veterans Act directs the Secretary to require poor-performing states to submit a plan to correct their deficiencies. Has any state been judged to be deficient and provided such a plan? The Act also requires the Secretary to analyze the extent and reasons for the state's failures to meet the minimum standard together with the state's plan for corrective action for the succeeding year. And again, have we done that analysis?
Mr. Chairman, to carry out that provision, we first have to establish the uniform national threshold enter employment rate. We have been unable to do that due to insufficient data. We are currently accumulating data under the new reporting system, and as I believe GAO mentioned, for FY 2007, we will have that national rate and we'll be able to evaluate those programs. However, in the interim, we do, on a quarterly basis, review the state's performance against their negotiated performance measures and take corrective actions by providing technical assistance to them so that they can achieve their negotiated rates.
So I guess then by that, then there have been some states that have had some problems?
Yes, sir. There are. By the quarterly reporting system, by the 17 performance measures that we require to be reported along with the 6 at the Public Labor Exchange, it makes it possible for a state director and the regional director to identify the state that is having a problem to then provide a technical assistance. I was talking to a regional administrator just last week, and he told me of a state that happened. They were able to respond. They were able to identify what was causing the issues with the problems within that state and help them put in corrective measures to increase their performance.
Have you got any other things? Again, thank you very much for your testimony. We do appreciate your hard work, and like I say, this committee will assist you in any way that we can.
Thank you.
The meeting stands adjourned.